Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
This podcast is sponsored in part by Eno, the Capital One assistant that catches things that might look wrong with your credit card and sends an alert to your phone to help you fix them. It is another way that Capital One is watching out for your money when you're not. What's in your wallet? See CapitalOne.com for details. CapitalOne.com.
I've always been a fan. I've been a fan all the way back when you were ESPN, when you called the quarterback Everett Crissy. Hey, Chris. And then Everett got took exception to it. And I was like, man, Jim Rome got some dog in him. Like, most guys would have backed down and said, okay, I'm not going to say it again. You said it again. I was like, I'm a fan for life of this dude, man. He got some piss and vinegar.
What's cracking? Welcome in, everybody, to episode 127 of the Jim Rome Podcast. I hope you're all well and that you are staying safe. This week, I'm going to play the hot hand, and I'm going to stay with the 1990s Chicago Bulls train. And why the hell not? It's all anybody is talking about while sports are on pause, and the Last Dance documentary is on heavy, heavy play. And my guest for Ep 127 is the one and only Stacey King. Stacey is a former Bulls first-rounder out of Oklahoma, and he got to Chicago 5 years after Mike and promptly ripped three straight world championships with him. And after a really nice NBA career and a fistful of jewelry to show for it, Stacey King hit the Bulls broadcast booth, where he has been just as remarkable. Nobody knows the Bulls quite like this guy, and frankly, there is nobody quite like this guy. So let's get it rolling. Episode 127 with Stacey King starts right now. Beep, 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 beep. I am so hyped, Stacey, to chop it up with you and get caught up. First of all, how you living? How are things, big dog?
Well, you know what? I mean, under the circumstances, I'm healthy, I'm safe, I'm with my family, in quarantine here in Illinois. And, under the circumstances, could be better, could be worse, but I'm in good shape.
Good. Glad to hear that. All right, so I appreciate you making time for this. Obviously, I want to talk to you and get your thoughts on The Last Dance and the three rings you won in Chicago. But, Stacey, before we do that, I want to talk about your indoctrination to the Bulls, which actually started before you were drafted by the team. You had this legendary workout against one of their big guys, which is even more amazing because you weren't physically going to work out for them. Can you lay this out for me? And if you have to go, it's a podcast now. If you've got to get kind of colorful with your language, you can. What happened in that workout, Stacey?
Well, my agent was the legendary David Falk. And, when you're a lottery pick, you really don't have to work out. You know, they have enough videotape of you. You go through all the physical testing at the, which used to be a combine for all the players. And you go to an interview process. And so you don't really have to work out. You do individual testing, vertical jump, your speed, all that stuff, but no physical contact. And, at that particular time, I come into, Chicago, I'm all excited. It's Doug Collins. And, we watched the Bulls a lot at Oklahoma because we had, a twin. Harvey Grant was Horace Grant's twin. He played with me at the University of Oklahoma. So we watched a lot of the Bulls games because of that reason. And then, Michael Jordan was on that team. So I was really excited to get the call to come work out for him. And so I get to Chicago, Doug Collins is there, Jerry Krause, all the coaching staff. So I'm excited, So they said, hey, we want to, put you through testing with our strength coach. Did all that, the customary thing that you normally experience. And I thought that was it. So they said, hey, we want to see you do some court work. So I'm like, I'm kind of like, really, should I do this? I don't really want to do this. And Doug kind of challenged me, and Johnny Bock, the great assistant coach, the defensive assistant coach for the Bulls during those first three championships, really challenged me, basically said, what are you afraid to work out? Tested my manhood, don't be per se a pussy per se. And so that kind of challenged me. And I was like, okay, cool, I'll work out. So I started doing these court works and, you know, screen rolls, pick and pops, you know, just all the normal stuff you put a guy through to see, you know, what kind of skill set he had. And then they come and say, hey, you know what, we want to, you know, this is getting a little bit too easy. We like to put a little resistance up against you, a little contact. And, you know, I'm like, I don't know, you know, if I get hurt out here, you know, it's before the draft and I don't want to, you know, tear an Achilles or, you know, a knee. And they said, no, you know, just, you know, it's okay. You know, we're not going to hurt you. You know, everybody's doing it, da, da, da. So I wanted to call David Falk to see if it was okay. But then again, you know, I feel like I'm being challenged and I didn't want to seem like I was soft. So I said, all right, cool, let's do it. So all of a sudden, here comes a guy. We were at the old multiplex where the Bulls used to practice before they built the Berto Center. And now they, you know, they're at the Advocate Center down in the city. So I see this big guy coming in. Now, granted, I don't know who it is. He looks like Dave Corzine, because Dave Corzine was still playing at that time. I think it was his last season as I came in that draft in 89. So he comes in, and, you know, he's got this wild hair. He's tall. He's a lot skinnier than he looked on TV. You know, I thought he was a bit bigger. So I'm thinking I'm going up against Dave Corzine. So the guy comes in, he's putting body on me, he's banging me around, and, you know, I'm like, yo, man, take it easy, bro. It's just, you know, it's a simple workout. You know, we're not, like, playing physical. We're not doing a one-on-one competition. So my thinking was, it's like, here's a guy who's, you know, was a starting center for the Bulls the year before. This might be his last season. Here comes a young lion coming in. So I just assumed he just wanted to show me, like, you're not going to get my position. So he's just banging me around. So they throw me the ball in the post. They said, you know, make a drop step and then spin baseline and, you know, lay it up or dunk it. So I proceeded to do that. And Corzine, who I thought was Corzine, like, knocked the shit out of me, like, knocked me to the floor. And I'm like, dude, what the fuck? What are you doing? You know, what are you doing? And so I got up and I'm ready to fight the guy. And he just said, you know, shut up, stop being a pussy. You know, and I'm like, dude, you must not know me. Because I don't know you, but obviously you don't know me. I don't put up with that stuff. So next thing you know, I said, okay, I'm going to get this dude back. So they said, everybody was laughing, you know, kind of Doug Collins was chuckling and everything, and they thought it was funny. And so I said, do it again. We're going to do that same move. They didn't say anything to Dave Corzine, who I thought was Dave Corzine. Like, hey, Dave, take it easy. Kid's just here, you know, to work out. They didn't say anything. So I said, okay, this is a test. This must be a mental test for me to see if I'm strong enough mentally to withstand physical play, you know, because at the college level, Jim, as you know, there wasn't a lot of physical play at the college level. You know, fouls were fouls. You didn't hard foul in college. So it's a different game in the NBA. So I said, okay, I'm going to show him I can play NBA style. So the very next play, I said, I'm going to get this Corzine. I'm going to tear his ass up. So they throw the ball in. I make the same move, drop step, boom. But instead of this time with the spin, I clocked him with an elbow in the face. Bam! And then I dunked the ball. And he kind of fell, you know, staggered. Oh! So then I took the ball. I got the ball at the net. And I said, play, pussy. And I threw the ball at him.
Great.
So he commenced to try to attack me. So I'm like, they separated us. I'm ready to fight. He's ready to fight. The strength coach, Eric Helen, and Al Vermeil, they come in and grab me. They, you know, everybody breaks it up. People are laughing. Doug Collins is having a blast with this. So they said, you know, Jerry Krause was there, the late Jerry Krause says, all right, just go to the dressing room and, get dressed and, you know, come back. We'll do the finish of the interview process. So I'm walking out and I'm with the strength coach, Eric Helen, who at the time was a little bit older than me. So he probably was about 24, 25. And so we're walking off and he's laughing. And he goes, man, we need somebody like you, man, because, you know, Pistons, you know, we need some people that'll fight, you know, people that will, you know, that won't back down. And he said, man, you really impressed me out there. And he says, he goes, man, you got a temper. And I said, yeah, man, I don't play that shit. Like, if you hit me, I'm going to hit you back. So then he starts laughing. He says, you know who you almost got into a fight with out there? And I'm like, yeah, Dave Corzine. You know, I'm like, Dave Corzine, like, you know, I know who he is. And he starts laughing. He says, no, that's not Dave Corzine. He says, do you even know who Phil Jackson is? And I'm like, who? Phil Jackson? Who the fuck is that? He's like, it's Phil Jackson. You know, he's assistant coach here. He plays for the Knicks, blah, blah. And immediately there's a regret.
Incredible. Incredible.
Like, you know, you have your full of air and all of a sudden, and you go all the way down to zilch. That's how it felt. I was like, oh, my God, I almost fought an assistant coach. I'm definitely not coming here. They're not going to draft me. I'm going to get labeled a bad attitude, you know. And so I go get dressed, get in the shower, and I'm hesitant to even go back. I'm just ready to call David Falk, get my plane ticket, dude, get me out of here because they're not going to draft me. And so I go back to the office. You know, Phil's not there yet. He's showering too in the coach's office, and it was just Jerry. You know, it was Doug Collins. It was, you know, Johnny Bock, Tex Winter. So they're sitting in the room and they're waiting. And then, you know, Jerry Krause, you know, kind of like reprimanded me. You know, he said, you know, you got to, you know, hold your composure and, you know, you can't, you know, fly off the handle like that. What if the Detroit Pistons, you know, we're in a game seven and the Detroit Pistons, you know, do that to you and you lose your composure and you hurt the team by your actions? And I said, Mr. Krause, I'm just going to be honest with you, then you shouldn't draft me. Because if someone slaps me, I'm slapping them back. And Doug Collins in the back going, if you aren't the sixth pick, we are drafting. We need more guys like this.
Oh, he loved it.
Like, I was just like, I started to laugh, but I didn't want to laugh because here's the head coach basically saying I did the right thing. And then you got the general manager telling you you did the wrong thing. So I was like, Doug's my kind of guy. That's who I want to play for. So then like a couple minutes later, Field comes back in. Now I know he's not Dave Corzine, so I'm a little bit humbled a little bit. Like, he's a coach, respect, you know, that's how I was, you know, raised, and that's how I've always been as a player. So I didn't know if it was over, Jim. Seriously, I didn't really know it was over. So he comes in, you know, he's got a duck to get in. He's a gangly guy, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's got that deep voice, and I'm sitting in a chair, so I'm telling Jerry Krause, like, before he came in, I was like, I hope this is over. Like, I'm sorry. I didn't know he was a coach. I thought it was Dave Corzine. And he goes, oh, it's over. You know, it's just forget about it. It's over. But he comes in, and you know how you can just look in a guy's face and you can just see that it's not over? You know, you just got that sense. Like, he had that sense. But then later on when I play with Phil, that's just his look. You know, that's just the way he looks. He always looks like he's mad or angry. And so he had that look on his face like the fight wasn't over. The scrap wasn't over. So, I kind of got my fist balled up, ready to jump out the chair.
Wow.
And then he goes, how you doing, Phil Jackson, assistant coach? And I'm like, that's when I knew it was over. So I was like, okay, good. Woo!
Incredible.
I have to get into another scrap, you know, with the assistant coach. But it was a learning experience, man. It was a fun time and you know, one good story.
Stacey, it's one of the greatest stories. I love that story. I love everything about that story. I think my favorite part, though, is when the strength guy said, you know, that was Phil Jackson. And your response was, who the fuck is Phil Jackson? And then you found out he was the assistant. Stacey, really quickly, the amazing thing was, and you hit it off immediately with Doug Collins, but he was not long for that gig. How long was it before you found out that you were going to play for the same guy whose ass you were about to kick? And what did you think when you got that phone call?
Well, it was very quickly because, you know, after the draft, you know, up in New York, you know, the Bulls do an introductory to the draft picks. And so myself and B.J. Armstrong and Jeff Sanders, who was in the draft that year, the Bulls had three first-round picks, you know, after a 50-win season, which was, you know, unheard of. And so we go to Chicago, like, on that Monday to do a press conference, and Doug wasn't there. Which is very weird, but I don't know the inner workings of the NBA as a college kid at that particular time. So I remember asking Jerry Krause, where's Phil at? I mean, where's Doug at? And he's like, oh, he's out scouting. And I'm like, wow, okay, well, because I talked to him on draft night, and he was excited. He was like, I can't wait to meet you, you know, and so I was excited to meet him and play for the guy because he just what I thought would have been my kind of coach. You know, no nonsense, a guy who really cared, had passion. I liked it, you know. So we got there, he wasn't there, and it was kind of weird. And then so I fly back after the press conference back to Oklahoma to Norman, and I get a phone call later that night. And this is before, like, social media and all that stuff. You know, you had to hear directly from the horse's mouth at that particular time during that era. And so I remember getting a phone call from Phil and basically telling me, hey, I'm the new head coach for the Bulls. We're excited to have you, and which is his first year as well. He had been a rookie coach as I'm a rookie player. And, you know, I'm really excited. And you know, I was just kind of shocked. I was taken back by it. But, you know, I just figured, hey, you know what? I just met the guy. You know, he seems like he knows a lot of basketball. And then I did my research on him when I got back home, found out that he won championships with the Knicks. You know, he was a pivotal player with that team. He coached in the CBA. So I did my homework on him when I got back to Oklahoma after the little dust up, you know. And then I got off the phone, and the first thing I'm thinking, and I told my girlfriend, who was my wife later on, I told her, I said, man, I hope this doesn't come back to haunt me. Like, he's now the head coach. He could have some ill feelings towards me. So
right.
That was the first thing that, you know, a 21-year-old kid would think of at that particular time. But, you know, it worked out, man, and you know, I was part of some special times here in Chicago.
No doubt. Now, Stacey, I've done this long enough. I remember you as a college player, and, you know, it's never easy, but there were times when you made it look easy because you were so big and so athletic and so quick, and you could just jump over dudes. And what I want to know is this. How much of your success at Oklahoma, when you were just dropping 30 on dudes nightly, how much of your success there was a direct result of that Jordan poster that you had on your wall, and did you bring that with you to Chicago?
Well, that's another funny story. I could write
a
book about this kind of
Hit
stuff.
Me.
So at Oklahoma, you know, everybody idolized Michael because he just came in the league, and he would take the league by storm. And I remember him at North Carolina. And so I was a big fan of him, even in North Carolina. And so, you know, when I was at Oklahoma, I had a poster in my apartment wall of Michael. And so, you know, before every game, you know, everybody has these superstitions and things that they do. It doesn't matter if you play sports. It doesn't matter what you do. People have superstitions and routines that they go to that they believe that makes whatever they do work. And that's basically what happened to me. You know, this poster of Michael Jordan, it could have been a poster of Prince. And if it would have got me 40 points, I'd have been a rubbing Prince, you know. But so at the, you know, I'd go to a game, I'd walk out the door, and I'd always have to rub the poster one time with my left hand because I'm a lefty. So I'd always rub it with my left hand. And so I'd go out and commence to dropping 30, 40 points. I'd have great games, you know. And then there would be times, Jim, that I'd forget to touch the poster. And I didn't play as well. And I always attributed that, oh, man, I didn't touch MJ today. Man, this is what happened. Damn, I got to remember to touch the poster. So it brought me luck in college, in my mind, you know, 19, 20, 21-year-old kid. It brought me luck, I felt, and that was the thing that got me going. So when the Bulls drafted me, the first thing I thought was not the fact I'm getting drafted in Chicago, is that now I don't have to use a poster anymore because I'm going to be with the guy. So being in the same room in the building with the guy, that's going to be way better than a poster. So my first game in Chicago, MJ's locker was across from mine. He was closest to the door and the training room, and I was over towards the shower. All the rookies were, you know, closer to the shower. So he was getting dressed, and he was, you know, getting his shoes on. He always wore his North Carolina shorts under his game shirt short. So he was in his North Carolina shorts. He was just putting his pants on, his shorts on. So he had no shirt on, so his shirt was off. So I'm getting ready to go out to warm up, and it's just me and him in there. So as I'm starting to walk off, I'm like, man, you know what? This is my first NBA game. I don't have a poster. MJ's standing right there. This is way better than a poster. So I go over to MJ. I take the left hand, and I, you know, kind of rub his shoulder, like, you know, rub down on his shoulder. And then I was like, wait, I better get another one just in case. So I did another one. So I go two. I normally only go one, but I go two. So MJ turns around, like, what the fuck? Man, what are you doing? I'm like, dude, relax. I said, I had a poster of you in, you know, when I was in college. It brought me good luck. And now I figured, hey, I'm playing with you, so, you know, maybe it'll bring me double luck. He's like, man, you better go back and get that fucking poster. So now that I look back on it, you know, later on in my life, you know, it's like as you get older, you go, yeah, that might have looked kind of bad at that particular time. I could see that was an awkward situation. But, you know, as a 21-year-old kid, you know, you're not thinking that. You're just thinking that, you know, hey, this was something that I felt made me better, you know, as a player. And now I get to see the live version of it. I get to play with the guy for the next, you know, years. And I could do this every game. But after that first little experience of the two rub down, I realized that there won't be any more of that.
I see you working, Stacey. I already done the same thing. Now, you mentioned off the very top that it didn't take you long to figure out that it's about the Pistons. It's about the Pistons and figuring out how to deal with the Pistons and ultimately get over them. So what were those battles like? For instance, were they physical or were they just dirty?
I think it was borderline. I think it was borderline. There was a physicality to it because in that era in the 90s, Jim, you know, it was a physical league. I mean, you had, you know, think about how many 7-footers you see now in the NBA that were like Shaq, like 280, 300 pounds. Back then, you had almost every team had two or three of those guys. And so that in itself made it physical. There was hand checking. You could actually put two hands on a guy when they drive to the basket. You know, hard fouls like we saw that were regular fouls in the 90s, you'd be in prison right now in this league.
For sure.
There's a big difference. You know, you can't touch anybody. And so with Detroit, and they took it to – they took it as far to the edge as you possibly could. I mean, when I say that, I mean, they did everything within the rules, the confinement of the rules, but they pushed the limits to the very end. I mean, they didn't mind giving up a flagrant foul. It sent a message to teams like, you don't come in here. And it wasn't just with MJ and us. It was with everybody. They intimidated everybody who played against them. I mean, if you beat somebody off the dribble from the perimeter and you were, say, 18 feet away and you had a direct line to the basket, you were constantly not even focusing on the basket. You were looking at, where is the blow going to come from? Is it going to come from in front, the back, the side? And then you might blow a layup because you're so concerned with where Lambeer was or where Rick Mahorn was or James Edwards or Sally or Rodman. And so you kind of took yourself out of the game, and that's what it did with everybody. And when, you know, as long as they were the bullies on the block, you know, they ran the show, and you know, the Bulls were trying to, you know, when I got here, I did not know how serious the rivalry was. I mean, I saw some fights at the United Center when my man Johnny Bock got body slammed by Rick Mahorn on the scorer's table, and Juwan Odom was fighting the Pistons. I remember that because I watched it, and that's when everybody got off the bench. You know, everybody, I mean, every team got off the bench. People were throwing things. Now you talk about the malice in the palace type stuff. That stuff was going on a regular basis, you know, back in the 90s. I mean, it would be bench-clearing brawls. It never spilled into the stands, per se, like what Indiana and Detroit did. But it was hand-to-hand combat back then.
Stacey, like, for instance, I've told the story, but to me, it was kind of like a lifestyle. I can remember back in the day, I was doing a TV show, and I had a panel, and Rick Mahorn was on the panel with the great Steeler linebacker, Kevin Green. And the two of these guys started talking shit, and kind of good-naturedly, but you know, these are two fiercely competitive dudes talking shit, and before you knew it, during a commercial break, they were about to go out back and either play one-on-one or get it on, and they were serious, both these guys. I'm like, fellas, you know, like, we're here to do a TV show, you gotta stop. But it was like a lifestyle. Like, Mahorn was not playing, and neither was Green, and neither one of them were backing down. And then watching The Last Dance this past weekend, like, Horace and Michael both made it pretty clear, they're still pissed that the Pistons walked off the floor without shaking hands when you guys finally did knock them out. Does that bother you? Are you still pissed about that?
You know what? I mean, it, at that particular time, I was. But as you get older, you know, Jim, I mean, what does it prove? What does it solve? You know, it's over and done with. You know, we beat them. At the end of the day, we beat them. We swept them. You know, we got over that mental hurdle that seemed to keep us in a certain spot, you know, where they just had their thumb on us, basically. No matter what we did, no matter how, you know, strong we got or how better we got, they always knew they had our number, and it showed. And then when we finally got over that hump, here's how serious the rivalries, because you don't see rivalries right now, Jim, in the NBA. Everybody's friends. You know, let's get on the banana boat together. Let's go to, you know, on islands together. Everybody's friends. You know, we go out to dinner. During those days in the 90s, there was no friends, Jim. I mean, we didn't like go and hang out with guys from other teams. Like, if I was in the Bahamas with my family, and I was in the hotel lobby, and I would have saw, you know, Rick Mahorn, John Sally, Isaiah, there would have been a Mexican standoff. There literally would have been like, it would have been one of those moments where, like, who's going to move first? Are you going to be, you going to come at me, or am I going to come at you? That's how it would be. It would be no, hey, Isaiah, how you doing? Hey, Dennis, how you doing? It was none of that. It was, we literally might go to blows right there in the lobby. That's how intense the rivalry was and the hatred between the two teams. And not only Detroit, but the New York Knicks, you know, we didn't get along with those guys either. So there was no friends during that time. So, and it also carried with the fans. It wasn't just the players and the teams. The fans hated, Chicago fans hated Detroit. Detroit hated Chicago fans. Knicks hated Chicago fans. Boston hated Detroit fans. I mean, it was really like there was dislike amongst every team in the NBA. That's how intense and competitive it was in the 90s. And, you know, it just carried over to even off the court. I mean, if you play for the Pistons, Jim, and I'm with the Bulls, and you know we're in line to grab a sandwich at Subway, and you're in front of me or I'm in front of you, we're liable to fight right there, not for the sandwich, not because I'm in front of you or behind you. It's the fact that you play for that team, and I don't like you, you don't like me. We don't even know each other, but we might go to blows.
And wasn't it so awesome? Hey, Stacey, like, I don't want to go all boomer on everybody, but when and how did that change?
Well, here's the interesting story that they kind of left off in The Last Dance, and they kind of hit on it, but it kind of went by it. When we lost to Detroit in Game 7 when Scotty had the migraine game, you know, Scotty took a really big hit about that. And I'm going to tell you, I was there. I witnessed it. My man Scotty was in some serious pain. Anybody who's had a migraine, has suffered a migraine, who suffers from migraine, they know exactly how he feels. They know exactly what goes through when you have a migraine. The guy was seeing double vision. He was in so much pain, he was crying on the way to Detroit on the plane. And so we all knew how sick he was. And that's why you'll never hear any of the teammates say, you know, Scotty let us down, Scotty didn't do this, Scotty didn't do that. Because we know, had Scotty been 100%, if Scotty didn't have those migraines, Jim, we'd have won that series. That championship Detroit won that year, we would have won. And that would have started an unbelievable run. But he had the migraine. And also, people don't remember, John Paxson, our starting point guard, went down with a knee injury in Game 6 and couldn't play in Game 7. So we were down two starters going into a Game 7 against the Pistons. That's something that's failed to be mentioned there, too. But here's the main story that I think that really turned us around. After the game was over, we're in the locker room, and you know when you lose a heartfelt game like this, this is my rookie year, and you know I understand how tense the rivalry is now after this playoff series. Jerry Krause comes in, you know, and he gives this spirited little speech, you know, like, you know, this is not going to happen again, yada, yada. No one was really listening to Jerry. No one wanted to hear from Jerry right now, you know, because you know the relationship, even back in the early 90s in that first championship run, was tainted. So what you're seeing, the relationship with Jerry in the, you know, 97, 98 season, the last three-peat, was going on way back in 91 when I first got there. So I saw it. So Jerry comes in and, you know, he wants to give the, you know, win one for the Gipper speech, and no one really wants to hear it. So basically he leaves. Michael Jordan, I'll never forget this. Michael Jordan stands up, and he's in this spirited conversation. Now, everybody in the room is looking up. Guys who are crying, eyes are looking up. They're looking at him talk. You could tell how passionate he was about this, how bad he wanted to win this series against this team. He stood up and said to all of us, this will never happen again. We will not lose to this team ever again. And he went down, Jim, to each and every one of every person in that room that was on that team and basically said what they needed to do. You need to do this, you need to do that, da, 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 da. Came down to me and BJ, who are rookies, basically said, you guys got to get stronger. You got to be in the weight room. You know, you got to improve your games. I mean, I honestly felt like there was a light, an aura, an energy about him that was transcended as him as a basketball player. So basically, you could just feel this lightning bolt just come through and hit everybody. And then that summer, which we never did, because in my first year, we worked out individually. We go two or three guys together. It wasn't a unity. It wasn't a team type of thing. But that summer, after we lost to Detroit, you know, in Game 7, everybody made a commitment to work out together. We'd all show up at the gym together. We'd all work out together. We'd play together. And we really started bonding off the court as a team. And that kind of was the turning point that got the Bulls on those championship runs, was that loss to Detroit, as bitter as it was and as hard as it was to take, is probably the best thing that could happen to us as a whole. It changed our whole perspective on what we have to do individually. And, Jim, no one was questioning Michael. No one's like, oh, man, we don't want to hear, you know, it's easy for you to say. No one was doing that. People were receptive, you know, because a lot of times in this day and age, you know, guys don't want to hear someone, you know, ragging on them or you know, questioning their toughness or their mentality. You know, you hear enough of that from coaches, you know, but we had so much respect, you know, for MJ and his competitive nature because we see it every day. So we know where this place is coming from. We know it's not coming from a place of, you know, bullying or anger. We know it's coming from a place of competitive drive, a guy who's getting tired of getting his butt kicked every single day by the same bully. It's time for us now, instead of having them take our lunch money, it's time for us to take their lunch money and continue to take their lunch money, which we did. And that was the turning point.
Right. It's a great story, Stacey. And the other thing, I got two thoughts on that. Number one, Mike was not going to ask you all to do anything that he wasn't doing himself. And number two, as you know as well as anybody, you often have to, every championship team has to get through that one thing or that one team. And the Pistons was that team for the Bulls. You know, I'm mesmerized, Stacey, watching Mike just sit back in that chair, drinking his branded tequila, cigar off to the side, and just roasting dudes. I mean, it's an amazing thing to see. Is that the mic that you know, or is the viewing public only still getting a piece of the Jordan experience?
They're only getting a piece. That's the PG rated, the Disney Channel, MJ. There's a deep and more intense side of Michael Jordan. I mean, I've seen it firsthand, so I know. And you know, I'm the type of person, like, you know, to play with Michael, you have to be mentally tough. You have to be not so much physically tough. You have to be mentally tough, because Michael will challenge you in ways that are outside the realms of basketball. Like, Michael will challenge you. He'll challenge your manhood. He'll challenge you. And if you were a guy who backed down and you didn't fight back or show him that you have fight in you, you know, then you couldn't play with him, because that's his way of seeing if you're mentally tough to help me go against Detroit. Are you mentally tough enough to help me go against these freaking giants that I have to go against on a nightly basis? In order for us to win a championship, I need guys who have the same mentality that I have, that can go out here and deal with the mental warfare that we're going to face against the Pistons. And, you know, he's that kind of guy. And the guys who played with him in these championships, look at Steve Kerr, for instance. Steve Kerr is a guy who got punched in the face by Michael Jordan. That's a legendary story. They got into a fight in practice. Steve Kerr didn't back down. Steve Kerr didn't say, "Thank you, Michael, can I have another?" Steve Kerr soldiered up and said, "Oh, hell to the no. You ain't going to punch me. I'm going back at you. You might be bigger. You might be a little stronger and have a bigger reach. But I'm going to show you, I don't care who you are, you're not going to put your hands on me." And he got the respect of Michael Jordan. You know, and that, I've seen tons of that, you know, as a player with MJ. MJ challenged you, you know, mentally, and Kobe Bryant was cut from the same cloth. You know, I've heard stories, you know, I know Kobe personally, but I've heard stories from guys when Phil took a lot of his coaching staff with him to L.A. So, you know, you talk to these guys and you know, what is Kobe like in practice? Because Michael in practice never missed practice. Michael never set out practice. Phil would generally have to force Michael to sit out of practice. Michael could play three games. And imagine this, because in a day and age where we got load management and all this other stuff that goes on, the superstars of the 90s weren't missing games, and they were still playing 13, 14 years at a high level. So it can be done. But I understand why load management is the way it is today. It's a different era, you know, with all the, you know, analytics and stuff that goes on. I get it. But I do know that as a superstar player, Michael Jordan didn't miss practice. Michael Jordan didn't miss doing suicide sprints like everybody else did. He was right there in the front line doing it. So Jim, when you're a young kid and you see your superstar player is the hardest worker, how can you come in there and say, "Hey, you know, I don't feel like practice today. My toenail hurts," or, you know, "I'm having a little soreness around my back area"? If Michael Jordan, Bill Cartwright, you know, John Paxson, guys who are coming in with a lot of aches and pains and you see are hurting and they show up to practice every day, how can a 21-year-old, you know, young kids say, "You know, I want to sit out practice today. I'm not feeling good"? You just didn't do it. You didn't call in sick when you're in Chicago. And if you look at the numbers, Jim, and analytic people look at the numbers, we had the fewest games missed with our core group. We didn't miss games. Phil, the games we missed, Phil made people take sabbaticals. He made Bill Cartwright take 2 weeks off because he said, "Hey, we need you for the playoffs." And you know, to Bill's, you know, credit, he didn't want to do it, but Phil forced him. You know, and so that's one reason why I say, like, you know, when you look at these kids, and I hope when they look at this Last Dance, these superstars of today, they look at how MJ and Scottie and those teams competed, not just in the games and in practice, how they came with a workmanlike attitude. And, you know, they were just, you know, kicking ass and taking names, and they didn't care. all the distractions. Think about all the distractions, Jim, they had to go through. You were during that time. You were reporting and stuff during that time, doing shows in that time. That team was like a rock star. They were like rock band.
I've never seen anything like it. And the people today don't understand it. I've never seen anything like it. They really were like the Beatles. And maybe there was no social back then, and maybe media was not the same way. But in terms of a team and a traveling band, there was nothing like it. And the way you lay it out is really so interesting and so fascinating. You know what I wonder, Stacey? If Phil Jackson made Bill Cartwright take a sabbatical, and guys did not have load management, guys didn't take time off. I understand this notion that Dennis Rodman is an example. This guy worked. This guy worked and worked and worked. I mean, he was legendary for his workouts after games. So when it was go time, he was always there. But I'm curious, what do you think Michael really thought? And they touched on this on camera. But what do you think Mike really thought when Phil Jackson went to Michael and said, hey, listen, Dennis wants a vacation right now? What do you think really went through Mike's mind?
Michael probably said, hell to the fucking no. I mean, we're trying to win here. We got people missing. You know, we're trying to get a championship. We know this is the last season. The one thing I will say this about Phil Jackson, honestly, Jim, I mean, he is a player's coach. He's a guy that, you know, a lot of these coaches, I'm in the broadcasting field. You know, I'm doing Bulls broadcasts. I see coaches come and go. And the one thing I can always say about Phil got it. Phil understood that this is a player's league. And he always supported the players. When you see in The Last Dance about the Scottie Pippen contract situation, you heard Phil, when they asked him a question, were you upset with Scottie when he decided to have his surgery later instead of earlier? Phil flat out said no, and he meant it because he understood, you know, what the players were going through. There would be days we'd come in, we'd have 4 games in 5 nights. And Phil would come in, we'd get ready for practice, and Phil would say, okay, we'd meet for 10 minutes. And then Phil say, everybody get the hell out of here. I don't want to see anybody in the facility. Go take the day off. Go spend time with your family. Get out of here. I don't want to see you here. And guys respected that because it's like, wait a minute. This guy, he's played the game. He knows what we're going through right now. He knows the stress and the pressure that we're under as players. Now he's saying, hey, you know what? Go home. Relax. Go hit some golf balls. Go chill. Go hang out with the family. He took the time to know his players, the pulse of his team. And what I mean by that, Jim, is not only just because he gave you the books. You know the legendary story. He gave everybody books on the plane, which he did. That is a true story. Every year, gave everybody books. But the thing I liked about Phil was the fact that he took the time to know you personally. Like, he would know, like, when I had my first son, you know, he'd walk on and, you know, how's Eric doing? He would know my baby's name, and he'd only met him once. He would know my wife's name. He would know all the kids' names that the players had. He knew family members. And so when you're looking at a guy like that, it says to you, and I know it said to me, that this guy looked at me more than just being a basketball player. He actually cares. And that was awesome. You know, I remember I had my second son, and he was going to be born on the day we had a game. And, you know, I didn't want to miss a game. That's how serious it was. You know, I didn't want to miss a game because that was our first championship run. We beat the Lakers. And I didn't want to miss a game. But I also didn't want to miss the birth of my son. And we were in Chicago, and he flat out told me, he said, hey, stay there as long as you have to. You know, be there for your wife, be there for your son, and we'll meet up with you when we get out, you know, west. And I ended up missing, you know, a couple of games for the birth of my son, and I never forgot that. You know, and me and Phil didn't always see eye to eye. No coach and player does. But the one thing I always respected about Phil, not just the X and O part, is the fact that he actually cared about his team and his players. And I really, really like that. He stood up for the players, and that you don't see that a lot.
No, I've got to think also, as a player and a father, you don't forget that stuff. Stacey, before I let you go, since you mentioned that, you've got, correct me if I'm wrong, you've got 4 boys all in their 20s, right?
Yes, sir.
All right, so you're in the quarantine life right now. Can y'all knock a few back, talk a little shit, and how fun is that for you now at this point in your life?
I tell you what, Jim, I mean, time goes by so fast, man. You got to enjoy every day. And it's funny, I can sit back and drink beers with my boys now and go, you know, have a good time, talk about old things. But it's so funny because I just remember them drinking juice cups and bottles, and now they're drinking beer bottles, and makes you see, like, man, how time flies. But for them, they get a kick out of it because, you know, my older son was born right during that first championship run. And, you know, he's a little baby, toddler. He doesn't remember any of that stuff. But, you know, now they see, like, you know, that their dad was part of something special. And now that this stuff has come out, you know, they're like, because in Chicago, you know how Chicago, it's a great sports, you know, city. And, you know, look at the 85 Bears. They're still revered here in Chicago, and they haven't won a Super Bowl since. And the Bulls with six titles, man, I can't think of any restaurant we go to that we don't get special service. I mean, the city loves their athletes here, and it's awesome being in this city. And, you know, like my kids, you know, finally get a chance to see things. And they finally see how good their dad actually was. And I got my jersey retired in Oklahoma. It hangs in the rafters, and I brought it to that ceremony. And they were like, man, Dad, you were really good. I'm like, yeah, I was. And I always tell the funny story to them. I'm like, because I was a big-time scorer in Oklahoma. And so I always tell them, I'm like, hey, man, you know, the only person that really guarded me in the NBA was Phil Jackson. That's the only person that stopped. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Oh, that is the best. That is the best. I mean, never mind that you could have gone first overall in the draft. Hey, Stace, did you tell them also that when you left Oklahoma to go to Chicago, you took a big pay cut? Do they know that?
Yeah, I took, you know, hey, I don't want to get anybody in trouble, but, yeah, I did take a little pay cut when I came here.
Nah, oh, man. Stacey, last night, this is so,
you know,
awesome.
Everybody assumes that in Oklahoma, everybody got paid.
I know, right?
You look
right,
at the Vols, and, you know, you look at all the football program there, you know. But I tell you what, man, I mean, you know, I've got nothing but love from Oklahoma. I was born and raised there. And, you know, who knows, man? Like, it would have been really cool, like, you know, to be able to play, you know, with Oklahoma City. Like, have an opportunity. Any NBA player have an opportunity to play at home, in front of their home crowd, their state, you know, like LeBron playing in Cleveland, you know, that'd be awesome. Think about MJ playing in Charlotte. How crazy that would have been. I mean, I'd rather see MJ in a Charlotte uniform than a Washington Wizards uniform at that time. Because I don't even count those years he played in Washington. And that's what makes this whole Last Dance so ironic, is because at the end of the day, Jim, that team had at least one or two more title runs in it. And it's so sad to see the way it ended, because they were so dominant during that run that you could have seen them squeeze out one title. And as you know, Jerry Krause's biggest thing was he didn't want the Bulls to end up like the Boston Celtics. That's one thing he always said, and I've heard him say it a million times, is when Larry got old, the Chief got old, McHale got old, they had the injuries and they were breaking down at the end of their career. Jerry's biggest fear with the Bulls is that he never wanted them to be like the Celtics. But what Jerry didn't, where he underestimated, was the ability and the athleticism that Scottie had, that Michael had, you know, Dennis Rodman had, that those guys took care of their bodies a little bit different, per se, than Larry. Larry and Mikhail and those guys probably didn't lift weights and do the things that these modern-day kids are doing. And Michael and those guys had at least two more titles in it. Because if you think Michael going to the Wizards playing 2 years, those are 2 years he could have been with the Bulls. You know, Scotty playing in Houston and in Portland and almost helping Portland get to the finals against the Lakers, you know. And those are years that, you know, Scotty could have been in Chicago. So that's what is really so sad at the end of it. Egos and personal pride got in the way of it, instead of saying, hey, look, you know what? We all should get credit for this. You know, we all are part of this. You know, it's great for the organization. Who cares who gets more limelight? Who cares who gets more press? At the end of the day, it's about titles. I don't care who gets the most press. You know, we all know that everybody's going to benefit from the organization winning, the Chicago Bulls winning. Think about now, the Bulls brand is one of the best brands in the world, and they haven't won a championship since 98. Mm.
It's so true. Stacey, one last thought. You know, when I talked to Scott Brooks about a week ago, and he was talking about how he was watching tape of Kobe Bryant in the finals recently from years back, and he said he was really struck by, you know, a number of things, Kobe being Kobe, but the fact that if a teammate made a play in a big moment, especially, how hyped, how fired up Kobe was. I'm curious about Mike. Like, if you made a big shot, or Paxton made a big shot, or somebody made a big play when it mattered most, was Mike really hyped on that? Or did Mike kind of approach it like, hey, man, that's your job. We prepared for this moment. Do your job. What was Mike's response?
He was hyped. I mean, I can go back to the Portland finals when we were down, you know, 16 points going into fourth quarter, you know, and Phil Jackson, you know, he'll never admit it, but we all know, like, you know, he was preparing for game seven in Chicago. So we're down, you know, 16 points, and he basically says, all right, second unit with Scotty, I want you guys to go in there and just, you know, just play hard. And he knew that we were all chomping at the bits to get in there anyway. So it's myself, B.J. Armstrong, you had Scott Williams, you had Cliff Levingston, and then you threw Bobby Hansen and Scotty out there. And so we came back from a 16-point deficit. As we were coming back, we cut the lead down to like 3 with enough time for us to come back and win. And the whole time when Portland was calling timeouts because we were making a run on them, MJ, you'll see it in the video. MJ's jumping up and down, you know, waving a towel, screaming, you know, cheering for his teammates. And, you know, he was that type of guy. I mean, you know, I know the frustrations early in his first 7 years, he might not have been that way. He was more focused on, you know, himself because the teams that he played on before the championship years were not very good. He was the only reason why they were competitive. So I think once he, you know, got the people around him, you know, that made him believe like, hey, we got a shot here. You know, we've got enough talent here and a deep team that we can win. He was always supportive of his teammates, always supportive of his teammates. And that's what made him a great superstar. He could be hard on you, but he could also come up to you and grab you by the head and, you know, give you a nookie on the head saying you're doing a great job and, you know, slap you on the butt and saying keep it up, which was a fine balance, you know, because that's what you need sometimes. Sometimes you don't need a guy grilling you all the time. Sometimes you need a guy to come over and grab you by the neck and say you're doing a great job. And he did that, and, you know, he was very supportive of his teammates.
Stacey, I never keep a guest as long as you, but you were so great. Final thought, like maybe what you're doing right now is not the dream gig. I think deep down your dream gig is to be a comedian with your own special on Netflix or something else. But broadcasting, my man, it's the next big thing, right? The next best thing.
You know what? Hey, listen, man, I've been thinking about that next gig I'm going to do, man. This is like it'll be my 16th year this year going into this next season. So I really love doing what I'm doing, man. I get to work for the team that I played for. It's awesome. But I can see myself, you know, doing a podcast, man. That'd be because then, podcast, you can say and do whatever you want. I just noticed that, and so I'm like, I didn't know you could say, you know, the drop some F bombs and stuff on here. So I think that's really cool, man, that you're doing. I've always been a fan. I've been a fan all the way back when you were ESPN. I saw a clip the other day, which is so funny, when you called the quarterback Everett Crissy.
Did you see that shit?
Said, Hey Chris, and then Everett took exception to it, and I was like, man, Jim Rome has got some dog in him. Like most guys would have backed down and said, okay, I'm not gonna say it again. You said it again. I was like, I'm a fan for life of this dude, man. He got some piss and vinegar, bro. I like this dude. I've been following his career, man. The Jungle. I watch all that stuff, man. You're one of the best in the business, bro.
Stacey, you are the best. I appreciate you so much. And by the way, you were built for a podcast. I mean, you could do a lot more than a podcast. But if you want to have a little bit of fun, you could show up an F-bomb. You can fuck this guy. You can do whatever you want on a podcast. Stacey, you're built for it.
That'd be
much,
a lot of fun.
That's it. I got much love and much respect for you, as I mentioned. I did not mean to keep you so long, but it was so fun. Stacey, thank you so much. It was an absolute blast. If you need any help at all with that podcast, you let me know. Otherwise, I hope we can do it again soon.
I appreciate it, Jim. Thanks a lot, buddy.
Now more than ever, we need people with the right skills to support our communities, especially the frontline workers who provide resources and care for those who are most in need. To help out, LinkedIn is offering free job posts for healthcare and essential service organizations that need to quickly fill critical roles with the people who are helping us all. If you are hiring for one of these organizations, job posts on LinkedIn can help you quickly find the right people for your front line. LinkedIn can help you find frontline workers from its active community of over 675 million members. LinkedIn Jobs screens candidates for the skills and experience that you're looking for and puts your job post in front of qualified people who meet your requirements so you can find the right person to quickly fill critical roles. To post a healthcare or essential service job for free, or if you're in another industry and you have hiring needs, simply visit linkedin.com/Rome, linkedin.com/ROME. Terms and conditions do apply. linkedin.com/Rome.
Baby.
Does anybody know how to post videos to Facebook?
Does anybody know how to post videos to Facebook?
What an awesome conversation with a truly awesome dude, Stacey freaking King, if you need him. And if you like that, at, go let my man know about it. He is on Twitter at Stacey21King. That's at Stacey21King. And while I'm asking you to do stuff, let me ask you also to get subscribed to the podcast, please. It's quick, it's easy, it's free. It will automatically bring you a new episode to your listening device so you never have to go looking for this thing ever again. And I appreciate you doing that very much. I'm going to get up out of here, but before I do, here are your voicemails.
First new message.
Aaron, you chocolate bunny cake. You cannot waste another year of your career in Green Bay. Ask for a trade. Get the hell out of there. You cannot end your career with only one damn Super Bowl, man. Get the hell out of there. They don't value you anymore.
Message saved. Next message.
This is Homie Hall. I'm getting the Presidential Medal of Freedom for restoring baseball and basketball next week. Athletes wear a clear plastic ball in their nose, red bulb and buzzer inside, strap around the head with wire to lithium battery on the belt, then to a rectal thermometer. Temperature rises, bulb flashes, buzzer sounds.
Message deleted. Next message.
Yes, it's Ken Milwaukee. As a Packer fan, I think we've seen this story before. Somebody drafting a quarterback when you have an older quarterback on his kind of getting in his older days. I wonder how this is going to turn out. I hope Aaron Rodgers remembers what happened with him and Brett Favre. We heard Brett Favre yelling, Yahoo! All the way up here in Wisconsin yesterday. Maybe when Tom Brady leaves Tampa Bay, Aaron Rodgers will be ready to step in his shoes down there. Hope you have a good one. Stay safe. Thank you much. Bye.
Message saved. Next message.
Holy shit, Conor McGregor! Damn, dude!
Message deleted. Next message.
Hey, King Jimothy, this is Lionel from Texas. Man, I love football. That's my favorite way to be entertained. I think it's the best sport. Check it out. The United States is where baseball was invented. Japan can hang with us at that. United States is where basketball was invented. Jamaica can hang with us at that. Football, if we tried to play, let's say, just one state, California versus Canada, you know we'd whip them. Or France play against Florida. You know we'd whip them. And I'm from the best state, man, Texas. If we put Texas against, you know, Japan, Jamaica, Kenya, everybody can gang up, try to fool Texas amateurs. You know we'd whip their ass, man. I love the jungle. Long live King Jimothy. Adios.
Message saved. Next message.
What's up, man? Smack, this is Ralph from H-Town. Just trying to live it day by day with this virus going on. Big interview with Imperioli. Big interview with VJ Armstrong. Definitely going to be digging back into my old Soprano episodes. Tyler in Edmonton, I thought his call was bad. Then came Roger Goodell talking about hold my beer. Raiders holding the 2020 draft next year in 2020. Tell me he just not just say that. I'm out.
Message saved. Next message.
Jim, congratulations. 26 smack off. I moved to San Diego in 93. I used to pack around a little transistor radio, listen to you when you were pushing 5 hours a day on the mighty 690. I've moved back to Canada, but I'm sitting here in the mountains. You betcha I'm going to be listening to you on June 6th, 19th. I ain't missing that one. Thank you very much. Peace out.
Message saved. Next message.
Brady is trash. I hate Brady. He can take those 6 Super Bowl rings and shove them up his ass.
Message saved. You have no more messages.